Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to Edgy Ideas. This episode, we have Dina Hassan from Egypt. Dina is a voice from Egypt, and I wanted to share Dina's voice and experience to our listeners. Dina, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me, Professor. I'm really happy to be here.
It's really good. I'm trying to remember when we met. It was in Dublin, I think, a few years back.
Yeah, I think it was about 2015, but I've been fangirling you for years, so.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
We met at a psychoanalytic conference. And
Yes, a few, I think.
Yeah, and I was very interested. We don't get many Egyptians at our psychoanalytic conferences. So you're a 30-year-old woman and you stand out. Tell me what got you interested in psychoanalysis.
Well, I actually was planning on going to fashion school to study shoe design, and I got into a really good school. And I studied psychology because I thought I'd be able to talk to my clients better and better cater my clientele if I understood the psychology behind it. And then I discovered Freud. And then I discovered forensics, and I fell in love with it. I was enamored by Freud, and honestly, the rest was history. I just didn't want to do anything else. He just made sense. It was very holistic. It went into body language and dream analysis and behavior. And I've always been quite interested in the human condition. And it just felt very philosophical and thought-provoking. And I was very, very interested to pursue it. And then with people would tell me, but it's so archaic and who does psychoanalysis? My response would always be, well, I live in Egypt and it's practically Victorian era in Egypt. And that would always get a laugh. And that was like my sarcastic side coming out. But the more I studied, the more it made sense, and the more it was more of a blessing and a healing process for me, because it just made me more philosophical and it made me more mindful and more aware of my own life and my surroundings. So it's been honestly a gift, the gift that keeps on giving, and I'm very grateful to be part of the community.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. I mean, we both share a love of psychoanalysis.
Yes.
For me, it's very different to psychology. It's a much broader. It's about civilization. It's about society. It's about the individual.
Yes.
About the
yes.
group. It's a very rich. Freud was really a revolutionary, wasn't he?
Very. And I love that. I'm just so bored of everything. Everything has to be tested now for it to be legit. And I'm so bored of the idea that every single human needs to be uniform, because we're not. We're all so unique. And what I really appreciate about psychoanalysis is that it kind of custom tailors every single need. And it makes more sense, because we are unique creations and we should be treated that way. We shouldn't be something on an assembly line.
That's right. That's right. Let's go back a bit. Tell us about yourself. You're half Scottish, is that correct?
Yes, I'm half Scottish. I was raised in Germany. So I got quite the mix, and I live in Egypt now.
So you're half Scottish, half Egypt. You were raised in Germany until what age?
Until 5, but then I kept going back every summer, and I went to German school in Egypt, but until 5, yeah.
And then you came to study psychoanalysis in Dublin, is that right?
Yes, at Trinity College.
But you were passionate about Egypt, aren't you? You wanted to go back and you wanted to go to try and make a difference back home. Tell us about that.
Very. I always wanted, I knew a few things when I was young, and I know it sounds very pretentious, but I actually really wanted a PhD since I was in third grade. That's probably because my whole family have them, and I always felt I would want one. But I saw in my grandparents how they revolutionized their fields, and yet they and they could be living abroad, living their best life, but they chose to come back to Egypt to make a difference. And I want to do that because Egypt is really literally filled with brain drain, and I just don't want to be part of that.
Yeah, I mean, Egypt is, I visited Egypt, I'm trying to think when, it was probably 15 years ago, and I was in Cairo, and I went down the Valley of the Kings, etc. But I was blown away by Cairo. The energy in Cairo is something else, isn't it?
How did you find it?
I absolutely loved it. I just love the energy and the dynamism and the smells and the...
What about the food?
I love the food.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it all. I really did have a great time, and I'd really love to come back. We keep talking about it. I'd love
Please.
To do some work in Egypt. But there's a real energy there. I just love the energy. It's a very young country, isn't it?
Yeah, and what I found really, really very comforting about Dublin, which honestly, I don't think my opinion should count because Dublin stole my heart, and I'm going to be biased, but... I found that there were so many similarities between Egypt and Dublin, but it's more like Ireland is a less adulterated Egypt. So it's like Egypt before complexes. But we still have, you know, we still have the mother-in-law who's really very passionate about her relationship with her son and maybe not the friendliest with the new wife. And we have this really family-oriented, collectivist kind of society. And it really wasn't a culture shock to come to Dublin. It felt like home. And it really makes me wonder, like, what do you think of psychoanalysis in Ireland? Like, how do you feel it fits in?
I mean, it's an interesting question. I'm trying to think about the links of between Egypt and Ireland, because a lot of people would be surprised by what you're saying. But I think there are overlaps, aren't there? And they're both post-colonial countries as well.
Very much so, yeah.
Music is really, really important to both countries. Religion is really important to both countries.
Yes. Yeah. And kindness.
Yeah, family and kindness and, connectivity with each other. I mean, that's what I experienced in Egypt as well, that real kind of connectivity and kind of people were reaching out to you all the time. In a very interesting sort of dynamic.
Yeah, I felt so connected to the people. I fell in love with everything about Ireland. It's just such a kind place to be. You know, it's a healing place.
Yeah, well, I came here to heal. I mean, I've only been here. I'm English, so I grew up in Bristol, and I spent my life in Northern England and then in London. And I came, it must have been, I'm trying to guess, probably 9 years ago, eight, 9 years ago to Ireland. And we settled here in Galway.
And that was it, huh?
Yeah. Well, I used to visit every year. I fell in love. I came in when I was in my 20s. I came for a holiday, and I was the best man at someone's wedding in Limerick. Mm. And I fell in love then. And since then, I had a little cottage in County Clare for a while. And I visited every year. And I just, I got hooked very early on.
I feel the same way. I mean, my degree was only 1 year, and I ended up staying three for no reason. I just couldn't leave.
I mean, you ask about psychoanalysis. In Ireland, I'm not sure about Ireland, but in the West, in Ireland and Europe, it's very interesting because a lot of modern psychology writes off psychoanalysis. They say it's concerned, and they say, you know, it should be empirical and everything should be proven, as you said. But there's also a second wave of growth, particularly coming from the French Lacanian tradition, and there's a real energy around it. And they're fighting very much this idea that human beings can be measured and empirically put into boxes. And they really fight that very strong. And then they say there's something very unmeasurable about a human being. There's something very unique, as you were saying. There's something beyond measurement, something beyond our own knowledge of ourselves, which, of course, we call the unconscious. And really... really a rich source for me of energy, and that's kind of energizing the psychoanalytic movement in Europe at the moment.
To be honest, it makes sense because we were bound to go back to what I want to call the truth. It makes sense. It's the only study that really, really looked at the human fully, you know. I'm not training human beings like a dog. I'm not looking at them like they're some kind of computer. I'm not looking at just one part of them. I'm looking at their whole existence. the philosophy of humanity, so to say.
Yeah, and it's always and it acknowledges always that it hasn't got all the answers, which I like as well. It doesn't kind of say, we can test this and find the answer.
Yeah.
Acknowledges that actually there's not answers there, but there's something which is unknown, which is the gap, the lack, the unconscious, even our own desire. We're doubly subjected. We're subjected to our conscious minds and also to our unconscious minds, and that unconscious stuff is the unknown, and it shapes us. It limits us. It does many things to us individually and socially, and it's always there, and that's what we've got to work with all the time to try and sort of deepen our understanding of ourselves and of society, I think. How does what work are you doing in Egypt at the moment? What kind of work are you doing?
Well, I did a bunch of things because I did a second master's in forensics, so initially my job was to work with people on death row. So kind of to sit with them and decide sane or insane, fit for trial, not fit for trial. Of course, not me, but rather a panel above me. But I would be looking at the assessment. But I also did a lot of work with addiction. I did a lot of geriatric work, and I started a support group for the elderly. I worked a little bit with the Ministry of Internal Development as a psychological consultant. I did some movie consulting, and I do online therapy now because of COVID. So that's where it trickled down to.
You've packed a lot in. That's a very rich, rich experience you've had. Very rich. Tell me, we spoke before. We went on air and you were talking about your experience of wearing the veil. Why? Tell me about wearing the veil. You wore it in Europe and in Egypt. What was your experience of it, and kind of why did you wear the veil?
Well, I chose to wear it because of religious reasons. Because we're asked to wear it. Of course, it's very hard and it's not forced on us, but we were asked to wear it. And I believe in it, but it's also... it's been quite the challenging experience. It was surprisingly less challenging abroad than it was in Egypt. Because Egypt is very, it's based on socio-economical standards. So it was quite classist, and the lower class used to wear it more often because it was more of a psychological thing where if they couldn't have anything of the world, they at least could have God. And so they sought out God and they became more religious. And so for some odd reason, becoming religious was seen as almost a faux pas or like a not very chic thing to do. Uh-huh. And so when people started becoming religious in like upper class and middle class, it was almost like, yeah, but this is like something that we want to ostracize. So it was quite the interesting experience because I was living in a country that's predominantly veiled. Like I want to say perhaps 90% of the women are veiled. Yeah. But those of my socioeconomical were not. And so I found it very, very difficult because I was constantly asked to not enter places and leave places or sit in the back or cut out of pictures, or like I lost a whole group of friends. I lost someone I was dating for like 8 years. Because it was quite challenging.
Because you were wearing the veil.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now honestly, I believe in it, and I think it really helped me understand who like the real people in my life were. And it was definitely, it's helped me in many ways because I started working on my own character and I didn't just rely on looks, which I think is essentially also part of the modesty in Islam, is that people look at you for your mind and not for your body, which is a beautiful thing. And it's quite respectful for women. People seem to see it like an oppressive thing, but like, it's quite the opposite. It's like, people don't deserve to see this because you are you're like a queen and not everyone deserves to see you. So I love the philosophy behind it, and I think it's very beautiful. But I think depending on the circumstances you are living in, it can also be quite traumatizing, which I found. So I really learned, I really worked on myself and my character, and I found it very beautiful. But I also, because of the circumstances I was living in, I also somewhat became the struggle. And at some point, I'm not wearing it right now, but at the end, I almost felt like I was the struggle, and I would look into the mirror and I didn't know who I was. And I felt like I needed to take a step back and understand who I am now.
So can I when you say your group, it's because you come from a more upper class community.
Yeah.
And for you to wear the veil, that was an unusual thing. That was
very unusual and very unchic, and like people see you like a second class citizen almost. And you're not invited to places. People don't let you into a lot of establishments. And people look down on you. They make fun of you. It's not a pleasant experience. It's almost like being a minority in your own country, which in hindsight was quite rewarding, because it helped me understand a lot of people that I probably wouldn't understand if I was living my normal life, because it's, as they say, like a smooth sea never made a good sailor. And that's really how I felt, like being put in a position like that, experiencing the trauma, experiencing, you know, feeling this ostracism or feeling, you know, like you're not being accepted just because you look a certain way in your own country, you know, it just really made me see other people in a way that probably if I hadn't done that, I would be more superficial than I am now.
I think what you're saying is very helpful to people. It's interesting. When I lived in London, I lived in Tower Hamlets, which is like the biggest Bangladeshi community in London. Mm. And majority of people were veiled there, women were veiled there. And there was a big debate going on. I mean, some feminists were against the veil and saying it was they needed to get rid of the veil to liberate women. And other Muslim women were saying, no, it is actually the word of it is a choice, and it's a liberation in itself.
Yes.
In a similar way you are saying. So it's a very complex.
And it's also one of those issues that you will never understand unless you are put in those shoes. Yeah. So I myself had many comments before I was veiled on veiled women. And I would have assumptions, and I would, you really can never assume how someone feels unless you are in their shoes. And that's something I learned through that. I learned so much. And I also learned that it really is dependent on where you live, because living in Ireland was the most loving experience that I had. And I was veiled, and I never once felt any of the things that I felt when I was living in Egypt as a veiled woman.
That's interesting. And of course, you know, there are women who have other experiences. There is racism in Ireland as well, and there are women who expressed other experiences. But it's very good to hear that you didn't experience that.
I never once had any racist experience or any treatment that was not kind. I was very, very blessed. It was really quite the healing experience. Everyone was very accepting. They honored anything that I asked or said. Like, they really respected my religion and my identity, and it was really very helpful for my character and as a healing process. Really, it really was.
Very good to hear. So what's happening in Egypt now with the COVID and with the economy? How are things there?
It's treating COVID like an STD, basically.
In what way? Say more.
Well. So, for example, people don't like saying when they have it. And if you do have it, you're ostracized and treated like you're patient zero of like some sort of horrible disease, and nobody can touch you. It's almost like people become very harsh with you if you have it. Yeah. And people are very anxious and worried. And I think it's bringing out the worst in people, because those who are not anxious are now anxious. Those who are not like exhibiting OCD-like behavior are. People are very angry, but that's also because a lot of people have lost their jobs and they really don't know where their income is going to come from. So they're very angry. But I even see the difference when driving on the street, like in my car, I see how people are driving now and it's quite aggressive. So I really see the difference. It's so like, it's a difference on every single level. We're not really very aware of the count, and I don't know how it's affecting the economy, because I'm not, I don't want to speak on behalf of something that I'm not very sure about. So I'm not sure, but I'm sure it's not helping the economy, you know?
Is life going on much the same, or is there a kind of lockdown? What's happening?
Well, people are creating their own lockdown, so people aren't leaving the house if they feel that they shouldn't. So, for example, I don't leave the house, but that's because I live with my grandmother. Other people are leaving the house because they feel like it's not going to happen to them. And then you have, once again, going back to the class system, lower class seem to think that this is a very, like, luxurious disease, so they're not gonna get it, and it's just for like tutti frutti rich people, so they don't even wear masks. So you go to a poor area, no one is wearing a mask. They think it's more like herd immunity there. Like the higher up you go class wise you'll find people wearing masks and being more respectful and more European, like I want to say, and like touching and not hugging. But then you go down and it's like, why aren't you hugging me? Like, do you not love me? Do you not care? Because we're a very affectionate culture. So when we don't touch each other, like when we don't hug, it almost feels offensive. Like we don't believe in boundaries. That's our culture. We don't really like boundaries. We don't really like to be told, don't say hi to me. It's almost offensive. So the lower you go, the kinder, quote unquote, people are, and the more loving they are. So it's more like that, I would say.
Yeah.
What is it like at your end?
We're in lockdown. We're not allowed to go 5 kilometers away from the house. All closed. All the restaurant, essential food shops are open, but it got quite bad here. But now it's getting better. So it seems to be like a yo-yo. We open up and the COVID spreads, we close down and it gets less. And I think it's going to be like that for the next 9 months or so, really. That's what it seems.
It's really upsetting, the prospect of 9 more months of this.
Yeah. It's going to be challenging, and, it's hitting the economy badly, and a lot of people's mental health is struggling because of not seeing people and not being able to mix.
Yeah.
So it's a struggle. It's a struggle for people, I think.
Very much. And it just, it feels like there's this card game in Egypt called El Shaib. It's whenever someone has the king, they're the ones who will die. But it's almost like playing this game, because nobody ever knows when you have the king, and nobody ever knows who he's going to give it to. And so it's quite scary and confusing. And then I think, if at least we had lockdown, like, I'm not going to pray on a lockdown, obviously, because that might be worse, but at least when you have a lockdown, you can control it somewhat. Whereas everything is open in Egypt, absolutely everything. Yeah. And so it's very confusing, because it's like, do we go out or do we not go out? And it's kind of creating this false sense of, insecurity and fear.
Yeah. You have a very famous Egyptian in Liverpool, Mo Salah. Have you ever heard of him?
Of course. He's a legend.
Complete legend, yeah.
Yes, of course.
I used to live in Liverpool and work there, so I used to watch them. So it's interesting to see how Liverpudlians have fallen in love with your Mo Salah.
Honestly, I don't think anyone doesn't love him. He's just a wonderful human being, and he's so charitable, and he like paid for all the marriages in his village, and he gives like a monthly salary to so many needy people. He's just a wonderful human being. We're very lucky to have him. Yeah.
He's a good example of Islam.
Of a Muslim. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. And a much needed one.
Yes, yeah, you've got plenty of bad examples.
We have quite the bad rep, unfortunately.
So is there anything else you want to tell us about Egypt? We're coming towards the end of the show. Anything else which you think would be good for the audience to hear?
Well, it's a beautiful country. We have amazing food, and hopefully when this is all over, you should come visit us.
Yeah. I hope it opens up again. And I mean, it's an amazing country. And one of the things I ask my guests and before we leave is, this podcast is based on the idea that we try to live a good life and create a good society. And I wonder if you've got any tips or recommendations for our audience about how to live a good life and to build a good society.
Well, I discovered, I know this is, I'm very old, very new to this trend, and it's very old, but I discovered mindfulness 2 years ago, and it's been a life changer. I think being mindful, taking the time to appreciate all the things in your life, even the small things, even like what someone says to you. So like good morning, and what it actually means when someone says that to you. And, you know, just appreciating every single person in your life is a life changer. And I know it's such a simple thing to say, but it's got such a huge impact. And I think living in COVID times, being locked up, you have more time to do this. And I think if there's anything we can take away from being at home alone, or at least with some loved ones, it's just, you know, take the time to appreciate.
Sure. Well, that's very helpful. Listen, it's been fabulous talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.